Gosh, that's a postcard.
Wow.
Isn't that just amazing?
Community and Human Services, this is March 12th, and we're having a public hearing on Senate Bill 5526, the Oregon Health Authority. Linda?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, today we start the agency presentation on medical assistance programs, so everybody's ready.
This is an interesting budget, and it's only $18 billion. Yeah, just 18
well,
billion.
We just think what we could do for the state police if we had that. And I mean,
well, wow. you know, for serving this committee, you all get 1% of the take, so it's okay.
Okay.
Wow. What you say,
Mr. Chair?
So, Mr. Chair, is this La Cosa Nostra?
Or? He's joking.
Just keep it to yourself.
You're on the record.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here. For the record, my name is Judy Moore Peterson. I'm the state's Medicaid director, and I'll be presenting today on the medical assistance programs, which is part of the Oregon Health Authority. Do you want to introduce yourself?
And for the record, my name is Bill Coulin, the OHA budget director.
And for the record, Kate Nass with Department of Administrative Services, Chief Financial Office.
Judy, would you like to take questions as we go along, or would you like to have us hold questions? What's going to be the best for you?
I think it'd be best for the committee if they were able to ask questions as we went along, because of the length of the presentation.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Judy.
All right, thanks. We'll go ahead and dive right in here. So first of all, I just wanted to outline, and these should all look familiar to you from the presentation, overall presentation of the Oregon Health Authority, but our overall mission and goals are related to the triple aim of better health, better care, and at lower costs.
Is there something wrong?
It's on this screen. It's just not on those.
Oh.
So it looks great.
Okay.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, we're good to go now. Excellent. Okay, so and part of our goals and related to that are more specifically related to making sure that we can determine eligibility and maintain enrollment for the more than 1 million Oregonians who are covered by medical assistance programs today, that we're able to actually accomplish the triple aim by working through and supporting the coordinated care organizations. We'll hear a lot more about that. And then also, as the state's Medicaid agency, we also provide oversight and ensure compliance with federal regulations for all Medicaid programs, regardless of what agency they're in. So for example, we are essentially, medical assistance programs are essentially accountable to the federal government, who are our partners in the Medicaid program for all Medicaid. And a good example of that is you've already heard from the Department of Human Services regarding the long-term care program and supports and services, and that is largely funded, is a Medicaid program, and we are accountable for that and provide oversight, et cetera, with the federal government for making sure that we're in compliance with all the regulations, et cetera. So those are essentially our mission and goals. To further break it down, I'm going to go through each of the various sub areas of medical assistance programs that are in our budget, as you'll see them in our budget. So first and foremost is the Oregon Health Plan. That's the one that most people are very familiar with. It is, as I mentioned, it is our state's Medicaid program that operates the benefits for physical health care, mental health care, oral health care, et cetera. It is essentially like health insurance for low-income individuals in the state. It is made up of both Medicaid, which is a Title 19 program, federal Title 19 program, program, and the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP program, which is a Title 21 program. We also have what we call non-OHA programs. There is a long list of them, and so we didn't list them all out, but we provided some examples. There is the, it's known as the Qualified Medicare Beneficiaries Program. And what that essentially is using Medicaid dollars to provide financial support financial support for paying for the Medicare Part B premiums or the deductibles or coinsurance, again, related to Medicare. Another example of a non-OHP program are payments to the federal government for the Medicare Part D prescription drug coverage, commonly known as the clawback. If you hear the clawback, that's what that is.
Judy, can we draw it back to the Qualified Medicare Beneficiaries Program so everybody gets on board here that have not been on the committee before? This is what we call the dual eligibles. And can you give us the rationale for why Medicare Part B is what was paid for non-hospital services for the most part, physicians and others. And if you don't pay your premium on that, you don't have Part B. You only have Part A, which is your hospital coverage. So maybe you can walk us through why we, in some instances, for low income, primarily,
very low income,
and primarily for elderly, why we pay the Part B, what the advantage of the state is for doing that.
I'd be happy to respond to that.
Let's consider it a softball, by the way.
Thank you. In order to qualify for the qualified Medicare beneficiaries, they are all low income, either seniors or disabled individuals. And if you are not able to, or if they are not able to pay for their Part B premiums, which are the physician, as co-chair Bates noted, they are the premiums for the physician and the primary care aspects having to do with the Medicare benefits. If you are low income, then you are going to struggle in order to pay for those premiums, et cetera. And so this is a way to help make sure that low income individuals, no matter what your age or your background or disability is, to make sure that you have access to primary care. It is extremely valuable. We also provide for, if you are below a certain income, we also provide the deductibles and coinsurance. In other words, when you go into the physician, and frequently you might be asked for a copay or a certain percent of that particular visit, and we will also use Medicaid dollars to also pay for that as well. Again, hearkening back to the concept of Medicaid, it really is to help provide health insurance or access to health care for low-income individuals, regardless of their background experience, et cetera.
If people don't pay the Medicare Part B premium, I believe they lose Medicare Part B, have no outside sources for entering the system, and end up in hospital emergency rooms, correct?
Yes, that is also correct. They would have no way to sustain that over time, and they would lose that benefit, and they would have to pay for all those costs out of pocket.
Unless you're in a state where Medicare payments are high enough that there is no premium.
That I don't know about. I only know about Oregon. So.
Trust me, there are states that is the case.
Okay.
That's a federal problem. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just a point of clarity for individuals who haven't served on this panel. There are different Medicare rates across this country, and that's what the good senator is referencing, some of which enjoy a much higher rate than we do here in Oregon. We have not been able to determine, you know, what factors determine whether New York and Florida and
Texas.
Some of those and Texas actually enjoy a much higher rate than the state of Oregon. We've often believed that we were penalized for doing good.
That's absolutely
true.
That's exactly why it's happened.
Yeah, well, we try to overcome that deficiency, but it's difficult. There are actually states in which the Medicare payment for to doctors and hospitals is higher than the commercial payment. And if you go to some of the states, you'll see advertisements on TV clamoring to get Medicare patients.
Really?
They're paid so well. Massachusetts is the one I see the most. It's amazing. We digress. Go forward.
We do cover, also included in the medical assistance programs budget are some smaller programs that are not directly related to Medicaid. One of them is the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, as well as the Care Assist Program. The Prescription Drug Program is a state-sponsored discount prescription drug program. There's actually a number of people who are currently enrolled. It's about close to 450,000 people. We have about two staff people who manage that particular program. And I believe that for this upcoming budget time period, we're undergoing a reorganization as to where that program sort of lives in the overall in the Oregon Health Authority, but for currently it is in the Oregon, it's in the Medical Assistance Program's budget. And the other program is the Care Assist Program, and that is for the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, and it is for people, assist people who are living with AIDS or HIV with their, with their co-pays, deductibles, and their overall prescription costs, et cetera. We are also undergoing a reorganization in that program as well in this upcoming biennium, but for the current time period, it is in the medical assistance program's budget.
Can I ask a question there?
Sorry, I missed you.
Thank you. Is there any copay for pharmaceutical drugs for OHP patients?
Co-chairs and Representative Kenny Geyer, you mean within the Oregon Health Plan?
Yep.
We do have some small nominal co-pays for if individuals are in are not covered by the coordinated care organization and they're in what we call fee-for-service, we do have some small copays, and I do believe there are some on prescription drugs. Those copays are usually $2 to $3.
Okay, and follow up. If they're within the CCOs, no copays?
Currently, there are no CCOs who charge copays.
Thank you.
Within their organizations.
I think that's correct. Mm-hmm. But they have restrictive formularies, too.
They have, most of the coordinated care organizations do use formularies, and they have the capacity to charge copays within the overall structure. None of them choose to do that right now.
Thank you.
Okay. So, currently, this is just a high-level organizational chart for how we are structured. We have the medical assistance programs report to our chief of policy. We're broken up into a variety of different areas that focus on program and policy. We have a client and community services. That's where all of our eligibility, enrollment, and call center staff are located. We have clinical services and quality assurance, as well as our overall program support. We have, in the upcoming budget, we have accounted for about 527 positions, or 518.85 FTE.
May I ask a question here? I'm sorry.
Yes.
So can you explain to me the difference between the medical assistance program and Medicaid?
And me, Medicaid director?
Yes. And who is the medical assistance program interim director?
Essentially what for the past 9 to 10 months, it's we've had this particular structure of the Medicaid director playing a different role. My role is as a liaison with the federal government, also to external bodies, as well as to you, et cetera. I've also played a role with bringing in the new eligibility enrollment system, which has taken up quite a bit of my time. We'll hear a lot more about that at a later time period. And then the medical assistance programs itself is more the day-to-day operations of the, you know, running and working with the CCOs, for example, actually processing the claims, processing encounter data, doing the day-to-day operations of medical assistance programs.
Follow-up, who is that person now?
The medical assistance, the interim director is Rhonda Busick, and she will be here actually on a couple days next week.
Thank you.
Okay.
So this is a chart of the populations that we cover by the federal poverty level. And it's there's a lot of information packed into this one chart, so I'm actually going to spend a little bit of time.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm so sorry. Can we go back one slide? Because I want to point out something that you didn't really emphasize. Your program, if I'm reading this correctly, is providing, I mean, not directly providing, but coordinating care for over a million Oregonians with 527 people?
That would be accurate, yes.
Okay.
That's good.
That's really impressive. And if you think that's the right number, great. If not, I'm sure we're talking about it as part of this committee, but I gotta say, that's a pretty impressively low number to be managing that many programs in such a diverse state as Oregon. So, go team.
Thank you.
I just wanted to point that out because, you know, people talk about government being really huge, and here's this huge program coordinated by that few people.
I just need to weigh in because our reason for going to the CCO community model was for just that purpose.
Right.
So that we could become mean and lean at the actually the state level where the work is actually being done and delivered at the community level. So just need to weigh in so that individuals out there who are listening don't get the wrong impression here. But that was the whole focus when we started talking about reorganizing and all of the good work that's been done by a lot of individuals in this building to do health care reform. Thank you, Senator Bates, who was one of the you know individuals who was very much involved, and others.
And Ben Westland.
And Ben Westland and stuff. It goes back to some of our stuff that goes back to 2003. I need to put that on record because some of us have been at this for a lot of years of trying to bend this cost curve.
Republicans, and at that time, Republicans were in control, and it's been a bipartisan effort.
Co-chairs. Sorry to interrupt Ms. Moore-Peterson, but I just think it's important to point that out.
Thank you. Co-chairs and Senator Stein Hayward, I really appreciate hearing that. I know that our staff work very, very hard, and I will definitely pass that along, and I know that they'll get a boost in morale for that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so now on to this information-packed a chart. It's what we use to sort of do a deep dive a little bit on the populations that we serve, what the, you know, how many people are in the various programs, and then what are the different rules, et cetera. In the last, since January of 2014, the Medicaid program and Medicaid eligibility has undergone a sea change in how Medicaid is determined eligible and the numbers of people, the overall volume and numbers of people that we cover. So it's going to take me a little bit to walk our way through it, but I think it's worthwhile to give you a good foundation in what the Medicaid and CHIP programs are. So I'm going to actually work my way through the big picture and then down into the greater detail. And we're also still trying to figure out right names. So we have like traditional Medicaid population, but that's not exactly right. What it really is are those populations who we are not using the new means test, the new income test and methodology for. And so examples of those populations in which you don't use that particular way of doing the income test for Medicaid and CHIP are people who are over 65, as well as for the blind and disabled. They are, while they are means tested, one, it's a different methodology for calculating their income, and two, there's going to be a different criteria that's going to qualify them for Medicaid. So in the case of plus 65, it is based on their age, that they're over 65, and so it's a different methodology. If you are disabled or if you're blind, then it's dependent on your disability status as well as your determination of blindness, along with whether you're low income or not. So
makes me wonder
the such big tax credits. The income level has the potential to go up to 250% of the federal poverty level. I just want to qualify that a little bit. In order to qualify up at that higher income level, and the reason that we have that mark off there of the SSI or the Social Security income level is because if you are at those higher income limits, then you are also receiving home and community-based services or another form of long-term care, or you're in the Employed People with Disabilities program. So if you do not receive some of those additional services, then your income needs to be below a little bit below 75% of the federal poverty level for just sort of the Oregon Health Plan.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Really quick, I just want to point out, I don't mean to not ask questions and just point stuff out, but I think you should, if people look at that last column about the breast and cervical cancer program, which says that it's serving 632 people, that's a program that I've been intimately involved with on the other side of my professional life for well over a decade. And prior to becoming a legislator, I served on the allocations committee that helped decide how we were going to allocate those dollars. And we could only serve 7,500 people in the state. And there were thousands of women who were not served and who did not have insurance coverage. We're down to 623. 623 women who have to depend on a separate program in the state to get life-saving preventive screenings. Oregon has one of the highest breast cancer rates in the nation. We're in the top two usually. So catching this disease early is critical for protecting people's lives and saving money, but mostly protecting people's lives. We're down to 623 people because of the Affordable Care Act, and it just blows me away. It makes me so happy, honestly. That's a statistic I just really want to point out. I'm sorry, Ms. Moore-Peterson, but it's really important, I think, for people to be aware of the changes. That's a really obvious result of these changes.
Co-chairs, Senator Steiner Hayward, we're also really pleased with those results. I do want to clarify that this is the treatment side of it. It's not the screening side of it. The screening side of it exists. It's in the public health program, and then if the women are found to have through their screening to have breast or cervical cancer, then they are referred to us. They do have to be uninsured, so that is one of the qualifications. We have been seeing those numbers drop in the number of women who are both being referred as well as needing the actual treatment. And in large part, we believe also it is due to the broader access to healthcare and people signing up and having access to health insurance already, and so they're not in need of this particular of our program. We do
Thanks
have 600 women who they either have a breast or cervical cancer, and this is the treatment program. They get not just the cancer treatments, but it's the full Oregon Health Plan. So they get all the, whatever prescription drugs, mental health care, dental care, et cetera. It's everything all together. So those are those two dark blue columns. We spoke a little bit about...
Mr. Chair, for the clarity...
Senator Winters.
Just a quick, and you might want to clarify just for the panel as to why we would carve out certain treatments, because some do not know that we have above and below the line when we talk about the Oregon Health Plan and some of the other things that go into making up the Oregon Health Plan. And so when we did the breast and cervical cancer treatment and some of the things that we've done over time, there's a reason for that, that they stand alone. In other words, they're standing alone. And you might want to put some context around it.
Co-Chair Senator Winters, thank you for that. And as we were putting this presentation together, we realized that we didn't actually spend any time on the prioritized list at all. And I'm actually happy to bring back additional, you know, written documentation if that's needed. However, just to briefly go over what the prioritized list is that you're referencing. I'm in our state at the advent of the Oregon Health Plan in 1994. We created a prioritized list, not we, but the state created a prioritized list of conditions and treatments.
Okay.
Yes. Not all of us, we. So,
I wasn't born yet.
Oh, give me a break. Stop.
We created a prioritized list.
It was pre-computers. We actually had pieces of paper we laid out on the floor. I mean, we really did. It was embarrassing.
We laid out the prioritized list of treatment pairs and conditions that essentially goes from the most effective that covers the most population, has the most value, to the least effective or actually harmful conditions and treatments. In other words, it's there's no evidence of any effectiveness at all. And it's I'm forgetting how many lines are on the list right now. I believe it's over 700. I'm sure I will be corrected by the end of this presentation, how many lines there are. And then it is actually an independent commission, the Health Evidence Review Commission, that puts together that prioritized list. And the commission itself is made up of health professionals as well as community members, et cetera. And they go through and they evaluate, and they evaluate as new conditions or new treatments come up, and then they place them onto the prioritized list. And then the other key aspect of it is that list is presented to the legislature, and then the legislature decides on the funding line. In other words, that these are the conditions that we are going to provide coverage for and fund. And getting to Senator Winter's point, some of those conditions or some of the populations, we've actually taken some additional steps to provide access to a broader range or to a full range of treatments, et cetera, potentially in case where the funding line is, that it might be too high to cover for their particular condition, et cetera. It's a way that to counterbalance that. Are there things that are in place in the operation of the prioritized list to help ensure that people do get treatment? For example, if they have a condition that is above the line, but it's complicated by another condition that is below the line, then you can get treatment for that, so that the whole person can be well, and that the condition that's above the line can also not get worse, et cetera.
I'll offer just a little touch more, okay? Since I chaired the commission for so long and was on it from 1989, the list starts out with the most important things to be covered, the life-threatening things. And you work down the list, you get to the more chronic things. And at a certain level, probably around 600, I have to look at the list again. You start running into things that are a little more optional. There's some stuff there that really is tough, prostate cancer at different levels and that sort of thing. And the initial run on this is you'll enjoy this. We listed all the possible diagnoses. There's about, at that time, about 20,000. And the effectiveness of treatment. And we didn't put in acuity, in other words, how serious the condition was. And we made the front page of the Oregonian and some national press. When we released the list, we literally put it into a computer and started spitting it out to us. The number one disease and treatment in Oregon at that time, because of effectiveness and cost was number one thing we're going to cover on the list was thumb sucking. And that was right up the top there. And Greg Wopat and I just kind of hit our heads, you know, went back inside and said, maybe we should put some acuity into this, you know. And 3 weeks later, we had a great list come out, and nobody cared. And then Olafund had us out there with a guy with sitting on a bicycle. So those things happen, okay. But it's fun. And we've had some other interesting things. When Viagra came out, I found myself sitting in a small church, Catholic church on the coast, and trying to figure out where to put Viagra into the line. And I'm sitting in this nice Catholic church, and every time I go by at the coast now, I still shudder. You know, what we're going to do with that kind of stuff. So it was a very interesting time, still is. But they give us a list that's really important, and probably the savings to the state at one point were almost $50 million a year, because it gives guidance to the CCOs how they're going to handle it and fee for service. Mm-hmm. So they really do a great job. I've obviously not been off for a long time, and since I left, they've gotten much better, and probably because I left.
So you're sleeping.
So they do a great job for us. Okay. I'm going to make a comment about this, if I could, about the slide we're looking at, and this is only my own way of looking at it. I think this is a form of insanity that we have to go by federal guidance on this. Mm-hmm. It's about deserving and undeserving poor. If you're a woman with breast and cervical cancer, you get treated 250% of the line. If you're a woman with pancreatic cancer and you're at 140% or 150 or 160%, right, you may not get treatment under Medicaid. I mean, it's what's been given to us. It's a federal issue. I wish there was a line out there at somewhere 250, 200% across the line. The state has to keep track of all these people. So when you say, are you qualified for Medicaid, and you go into the system and look at the computer system to help you do it, it's not a simple decision.
No.
You've got to look at all these different things going on and filter that through and get them qualified. Then people are coming on and going off. If your child gets older, if a child moves away, if you have another child, it's really complex. It makes it very difficult for states, especially when we have a million people now in there. So mm-hmm. I appreciate when you say we've got the call time down to 7 or 8 minutes and we can get you signed up in a short time. It's kind of amazing because you got to go through this maze as well as all the information you have to collect.
It is complicated, yes.
Yeah, it's terrible. But it's what we have, and we have to live with it. It's a federal, our federal partners are giving us $2 every dollar we put in, so we... Until we get this changed, we have to live with it. It used to be worse. Mm-hmm. It used to be, 18 categories at one time?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it was 18 was the number.
A couple of clarifying questions. One is, are not all of this is federally dictated because the state got to choose on the ACA adults to go to 100 versus 133. Is that true? And are there other categories that... where we have some leeway in it? So that's one question. The other is, why are children 0 to 1 included under the pregnant women column when they're also included in the higher column next to it? And the third is, sometimes you hear the ACA 133%, 138%. I know there's some different way of calculating. If you could explain that to remind me.
Okay, so you might have to repeat the questions because I...
Federal versus
you
state.
Them. But, okay, so... which one's...
Which ones are federal required?
Federal versus state.
Oh, federal.
State option.
Okay. All right. Optional the concept of mandatory and optional Medicaid populations and CHIP populations. So here we go. Pregnant women and infants, you have the choice. It is optional to cover pregnant women up to 185% of the federal poverty level. If you run a Medicaid program, it is mandatory that you cover pregnant women up to 133% of the federal poverty level. The reason that there are infants in that category is because they are the infants born to the pregnant women. So it's a specific category of if the woman was covered by Medicaid before the birth of the child, before her baby, then the infant lands in this category. If the mother was not covered by Medicaid, but the infant was either they can still qualify, because as you see, the category goes up to 300% of the federal poverty level, not 185. So you have pregnant women who are not covered by Medicaid at the time of the birth of their child, but their child can qualify for Medicaid or CHIP. So moving to the next column of children.
I'm sorry,
children.
Mr. President.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, sorry.
Mr. President.
Mr. President, sorry.
Who's my bodyguard?
I apologize. I'm sorry. So I'm a little confused, and I just want to make sure I understand this. Mm-hmm. My recollection is that historically we've been at about 50% of babies born in this state were born via with their mothers covered by Medicaid, or 50% of pregnancies in the state were covered by Medicaid. And I thought we were running at about 45,000 births a year in the state, and the number in that column is less than 45,000 in terms of the women part of it, right? And if you look at the numbers underneath, like it talks about women, 18,000, something like that. So are those women who were not on Medicaid before they became pregnant and then became eligible because they were pregnant, but otherwise were not eligible?
Okay.
I apologize. I mean, because if a woman's already on Medicaid and becomes pregnant, then obviously she's covered still. So help
for
me parse that out.
Right. Okay. So the pregnant women are, by virtue of them being pregnant,
right, categorically eligible.
Categorically eligible. They're eligible for the time in which they are pregnant to the birth of their child plus 60 days postpartum. We do pay for 50% of the births, not 50% of the pregnancies. In other words, it's not all the women. There are...
That's interesting.
Right. So that it's not 50% of all women, pregnant women, are mm-hmm. covered by Medicaid. It's that 50% of all the births are paid for using Medicaid. And the difference is, of course, that some women might have private coverage. There's lots of different factors as to why they may not be covered under Medicaid. So it's 50% of all the births
right.
are paid for. So this is a snapshot in time.
Okay.
And so it is not a count over the entire year
okay.
of how many people are covered in these various categories. This is a snapshot in time, you know, sort of like on one particular day, this is how many people were in all these categories, which is how you can also wind up having the numbers be actually the numbers that are the total numbers of people who would be on the Medicaid program or pregnant women who would be on the Medicaid program over the year would be much higher than this.
Okay.
So those are all the different factors that would lead to that thing. Here you have the infants broken out, but you don't have, there's a number of infants, and I can break it out, although I don't know if I have the number here with me, about how many are under one or not. And again, this would be a snapshot in time, and it's not the infants, but...
Judy, while you're looking...
Yes, about 26,000, I think, is about infants.
Because she asked the question on the federal poverty level, state versus feds. And we do have some latitude. In fact, it was 2003, and I chaired the group on the Oregon Health Plan, because we were faced with budgetary crisis and we needed to make some real decisions on what we were going to determine as the eligibilities. And we determined then, and it became a policy decision, that we would increase the pregnant women and infants, and that's how that went up. A lot of these, there are some discretions that we have as a state. I don't want you to think that we don't, because that the outcome of a lot of this came as a result of the work group that was put together on the Senate side in 2003 to balance a budget.
And correct me if I'm wrong, for the most part, Oregon is elected to push the limits what the feds will allow.
Yeah.
Try to stop cost shifts and actually get care. In a real life situation that is commonly seen, as far as pregnant women or women who have men and women who have a family has kids, is not uncommon, and actually is fairly common, for the parents to have no health insurance, mm-hmm. but the children to be covered by Medicaid. okay, or they have to buy into the exchange or get something from work. Mm-hmm. But there's a big chunk of people there. The kids are insured. Parents aren't. Mm-hmm. The parents have co-pays and deductibles. If they are, kids are paid first dollar. So that's a very common scenario.
So I don't mean to belabor this, so to speak, but the kids who are, you know, 3 months old and are 200% in poverty, I'm not sure if they're in the right or left column. I don't understand how you could have, you know, on one hand...
They're under the CHIP program.
Yeah, so why are they even...
Because their parents are too high a level to qualify.
The kids are...
The parents are out, the kids are in.
It's a very... We tried to deal with this 2 years ago. We couldn't do it.
I told you it was the same, didn't you?
Look at the kids, three months old are always up to 300% of poverty, right?
That is an accurate statement.
That's why I have a hard time understanding why they're even included in that very left, like...
The only reason they're included on the left-hand statement, on the left-hand side, is because they get Medicaid match, not CHIP match.
Right.
And because they are the babies of the women who were covered on Medicaid at that time period.
I think another way of looking at it is that we try very, very hard in this state to maximize our leveraging abilities.
Right.
Our leveraging of federal dollars.
Yes. And so looking at the various categories and how we can make them fit to where we're getting the maximum that we can attain, that's overriding. So on budget, it's very, you need to know those kinds of.
Yes.
I just got it for where you just last said it. If you put Medicaid in that very left hand column,
yes,
they're covered by Medicaid. On the other hand, the people at 150% in the other column are not covered by Medicaid. Finance. They're covered by CHIP.
If above that 133.
I now I get it.
Okay.
So maybe you can just add Medicaid to it.
Yes, we could put Medicaid, pregnant women and infants. That I'm sure that would be helpful.
Yeah.
And that is a nice segue to the fact that allowing me to explain the difference between Medicaid and CHIP and the fact that Medicaid has a lower match rate with the federal government than CHIP does. It is about 62% for Medicaid currently, and it's about 72% for CHIP. There is a difference there as to how they're covered. And when we get to the concept of optional versus mandatory, the children up to 133% under Medicaid, that's mandatory. If you run a Medicaid program, you need to cover it up to 133%. There were some changes in 2014. It used to be a different poverty level for 6 to 18 versus 0 to 6, but in that particular category, we've had some simplification. It's all children, Medicaid up to 133% of federal poverty level. In our state, we choose to take the CHIP program up to 300% of the federal poverty level. We actually run the concept is a separate CHIP program that is a Medicaid lookalike. In other words, it has the same benefits, the same package as the Medicaid program. It is a Title 21. There are a few differences between the two, between Medicaid and CHIP in the qualifications. The most significant is that you have to be, the children in the CHIP program have to be uninsured, and whereas in Medicaid, they can actually have forms, they can have other forms of insurance or access to other forms of insurance, and then Medicaid becomes the secondary. Moving on, and I'm going to skip over the age blind and disabled and go to the ACA adults, in which I can also then answer why does this say 133 and you keep hearing about 138, which is also another complicating factor, which I hope I can also address. So the we call them the ACA adults. They are adults who formerly could not have been covered by traditional Medicaid unless the state had a waiver. So, and the 133% is the federal level, and it aligns with the KIDS programs of 133. It is made up of largely adults without children and with children, regardless. But and in our state, which I'll get to a slide that shows, that demonstrates that we had a population that we served on a limited basis before then. In our state, with a Supreme Court ruling, states did have the option as to whether to expand Medicaid or not and provide coverage. If we choose to not provide coverage, then you can't provide coverage. Even it's not like at 100% or below. It's that you can't serve that population. So it is 133 in that particular population. They became part of the Medicaid population at that point. So the reason that it's that you see it as 133 here, but frequently, and I know I say it as well, it's 138%, is because in the other way of calculating income, in the prior method of calculating income, we would say, okay, we're not going to count this form of income, like if you get child support or if you have this, then we're not going to count that. And those were all called disregards. And so instead of, and every state had different disregards. So instead of the federal government, as they were coming up with this, you know, what are we going to do here? Instead of saying, okay, you know, every state, we're going to have to calculate exactly how much your disregards were, et cetera. We're just going to tell you it's 133% plus 5% for any income disregards that that you had in place. And the reason that that was put in place is because by putting it at 133, there would have been some populations or some families whose income in that category that had formerly been disregarded that now would count in their income, that would allow them to then get the Medicaid coverage. It was a way to try to protect the adults or the adults who are in that category. So that's why you hear it's technically in the law, et cetera, it's 133%, but then it's the plus 5%, and that's why many of us say 138% of the federal poverty level. Let's see, that we do have some choices on the aged, blind, and disabled populations. You can go to a lower income level if you wanted to, but then you start cutting off all the people who have the home and community-based services programs, and then they would have access to those and not access to the other physical health care. And it becomes very sort of complicated. There's a lot of different rules around that particular thing, but that's another considered sort of option that our state has taken. The breast and cervical cancer treatment program is also optional.
On the optional part, for the age, blind, and disabled, do the feds give us a higher match rate to incentivize us going to the higher level?
They do not.
Okay, thank you.
No, but they do give us incentives as far as waivers for being able to run a home and community-based service programs, and then you would lose those. So it's not a higher match rate, but it is the ability to have the flexibility to provide the kind of long-term care supports and services in the home and in the community as opposed to a nursing facility. Those go together. The breast and cervical cancer treatment program is an optional program that we have continued to take that option. The qualified Medicare beneficiaries, which we began to speak about, is not optional either. I do want to note that until 2019, we do have the federal government, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, has put in a maintenance of effort requirements for children. They had one for both adults and children. The one for adults stopped in January of 2014. The one for children goes through 2019, I believe.
So what is the maintenance of effort?
Maintenance of effort means that you cannot change your eligibility rules to be more restrictive than what they were at a particular date and time. And I think it's 2010 or something like that. So it's a particular date and time, and I believe it goes through January of 2019. Okay. So if we're looking at, did I answer all those questions?
Thank you, yes.
Okay, so.
Stay on this slide for another 3 minutes, according to Senator Steiner Haywood. You have now broken the record for a single slide in time.
It's our fault, not yours, Ms. Peterson. I just think it's funny.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, as I did say, this was an information-packed slide.
It's very important. I'm just kidding you. Very important that people understand this.
Okay. So, I don't think I've broken a record before. So looking at the aged, blind, and disabled, just so people have a concept or an idea about the breakdown in the populations, about 82,500 or 82,600 of that total amount are in the blind and disabled program, and then about 38,700 are in the over 65 program. Talking a little bit about the qualified Medicare beneficiaries, I think it's sometimes helpful just to know that below 100% in that basic column means that we provide the copays and the deductibles, as well as the premium payments. The little band there, that's 120%, and the 135%, we pay for the Part B premiums only, and it's not the copays and deductibles. And then the 135% band is federal funds only, and it is they give us a certain amount of money, and so at times that particular program has had to be capped and not take any new individuals in as we get close to running out of the federal dollars that are available for that. One more aspect about the demographics of the population, not necessarily the federal poverty level. Aspects of it is that within, as I mentioned, that we've had a pretty dramatic shift in not just volume, but also in the overall demographics of the population. Prior to this, our population of kids children tended to make up about 2/3 of the population of the overall Medicaid and CHIP population. And today, kids are about 40% of the population. And adults between the ages of 19 and 64 are about 56%. Again, that's a pretty dramatic shift in population and who we're serving today. The other interesting factor, which I thought was of interest, is that it used to be a lot more women, proportionately more women. Again, it was about 60% women and 40% male. And now it's about 41% female and 59% male. So again, we've had a shift in demographics. I don't know if it's going to hold over time, but that's it's a pretty dramatic change in that particular population. I think I've exhausted most of the conversation on this particular topic.
You've broken the record. Thank you.
You're welcome. It's quite the record to hold. So I'm not sure how to take that.
I think it's a good thing. It means that you have an interesting, thoughtful slide that's presented in ways that gives a lot of information and you've done a good job answering a lot of questions about it. So,
thank you. So, moving on to the next slide. I think this also dramatically kind of explains and demonstrates the change in that we've undergone in the last year and a bit. As I mentioned, in January of 2014 is when the change happened and how we calculated income. It's also when we took on the Medicaid expansion population. I was hoping that I would never, ever have to explain what OHP Standard and OHP Plus was again, but here it is on this slide, and hopefully this is the last time ever. So, prior to January of 2014, we had taken up an option in our state through a waiver, in other words, through a particular exception process with the federal government and how to run the Medicaid program to cover, in a limited way, adults under 100% of the federal poverty level who didn't meet any other traditional Medicaid criteria. We had about 60,000 individuals in that particular population, and their benefits that they had were somewhat different. They were more limited than what they were in the OHP plus population. The OHP plus population was all the rest of the populations who received full Oregon Health Plan benefits. It was all the pregnant women, the children, the age blind and disabled, and some of the other populations that you saw on the prior slide. So, after the expansion, the reason that this is shown this direction is that what that expansion also meant is that everybody wound up getting the same benefit package. So now all adults have the same benefit package, and it's not separated between that notion of plus and standard. We also got a lot more. There's about 380,000 individuals now in that ACA adult population that we're now covering. Okay. Moving along. And then the other thing that I think is also helpful to know about the particular populations, and this sort of demonstrates this graphically, is that while you can have a lot of the population, their cost, how much they cost, what their healthcare expenditures are very different depending on who they are and what their background is. So it's not too surprising that, 40%, as I mentioned, for about 40% of the population are kids, but they make up just under a quarter of the spending if you're doing that kind of comparison. You can cover a lot more kids for the same dollar that you would for adults. And then adults in this particular category of like the ACA adults, et cetera, and the parents and caretaker relatives, they make about 42% of the population, but you can see that they're slightly more expensive on a relative basis. I think most dramatically are the people with disabilities, they make up about 9% of the population and about 20%. Now that number, that 20%, would actually be much higher if we incorporated about 20% of that population of the disabled population actually has Medicare, and Medicare picks up a lot of the hospitalizations they pick up all the hospitalizations as well as the a lot of the physician costs, et cetera. So if you were to calculate in the full cost of all of their acute care that they would need, mental health care, et cetera, then that figure would go up much more than that. And the other thing I also wanted to note is if you put in their costs in the other agency of DHS and their long-term care costs, the costs for both the elderly and the people with disabilities, again, would go up. So this is representing the Oregon Health Plan and their physical health care costs, and just relatively speaking, but I don't want to misrepresent the overall costs that are associated with the people that we cover by Medicaid in general. moving along. Now we get to the money part. Mm. Okay. So, medical assistance programs makes up the bulk of the largest proportion of the overall Oregon Health Authority's budget at a total fund figure of $13.2 billion. About $12 billion of it is the medical assistance programs, a portion of it. That's your the Oregon Health Plan. As I mentioned, we have those non-OHP programs. That makes up about 5% at $665 million. The other programs, that's the Care Assist and the prescription drug program, is about 1% at $79 million, and that's obviously rounding. And then I do want to note that our program support, that's all the, you know, all of our people, all of the administrative support, et cetera, is about 1% of our total budget at $260 million. I'm going to move along to the next slide. Oh, this is broken up by fund type, right?
Correct.
Okay. Okay, so the other thing of note within our budget is that it is by far made up largely of federal funds. I think, as I mentioned, the Medicaid program is a federal-state partnership in which the state puts forward a certain percentage, and we get different match rates for different populations. And then we we also have a series of other funds, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. And then in the governor's recommended budget, we have about $1.2 billion in general fund revenue. So, but by far, the largest proportion of our budget is actually federal funds. And I think I should have spent more time on that particular slide, in that the ACA population on that FPL, they get 100% federal match. We'll talk a little bit more about the changes in that federal match over time. It's in a later part of the presentation. Any questions? Okay. So I wanted to break out the other fund, because it's made up of a variety of different elements to it, and I think it's good to note that about $1 billion of it is coming from the hospital assessment, which is about half of that other fund amount. We also have $290 million, or it makes up about 15% in tobacco tax, about $137 million or 7% is in the tobacco tax settlement, the master settlement agreement. And I, again, I will spend more time talking about what DSHP stands for, Designated State Health Programs. And we'll go into that a little bit later, but that's about $136 million of other funds, and that's about 7% of that other fund bucket of dollars. And then $79 million in drug rebates comes into our budget. Okay, moving along. All right.
I'm in a metal block here. Tobacco settlement, tobacco tax.
Mm-hmm.
DSH and drug rates. The other three are 13, 16% of it. I just don't remember what that is. I'm sorry. I'm a metal block.
This 16%?
Yeah.
It is made up of a variety of different things. We have some one-time funds in there as well. Like, for example, the hospital assessment. There was some leftover dollars. That's about $125 million. We have something we call leverage. In other words, we have with other public entities and like counties, Oregon Health Sciences University,
they use them for match money, and they get
exactly. They give us the state fund portion of it, and that's about $109 million. And then those dollars go, you know, get out to the.
Is there any one-time money in there?
There is some one-time money. The hospital assessment
is in there. Leftover hospital assessment from.
That's about $125 million.
So it's one-time money.
One-time money.
For this biennium.
For this biennium, yes.
But get a chance, break it out for us so we can take a look at it.
Sure.
Okay, that's another shortfall to think about in 15 and 17.
Of what the one-time monies are, yes.
Yeah.
Happy to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you.
She's happy to do that.
Judy, the tobacco tax settlement money, the $137 million, is that's for the biennium? How much is total? I know that's been a long-standing thing.
It is a long-standing thing.
I kept thinking we were in the 80s or something.
I have that information, but I'll need to bring that back to you.
Okay.
I believe that the settlement dollars, we think that goes through about 2019, but I don't have the figures on how much in total it's been.
Oh, sorry.
But Kate does.
Thank you. Chair Bates, Representative Boone. The Master Settlement Agreement in DAS does the Department of Administrative Services watches the cash flow on that and pays the debt service that needs to be paid out of it in the beginning, and then there's money available left over to use for program. And the governor's budget puts the $137 million in. We don't see an end in sight for that Master Settlement Agreement money coming into the state. However, the state has a choice of how we use that money. The governor's budget uses it in the health plan.
So just a quick follow-up. Is it a continuing thing? I thought it had a cap and there was
I'm sorry, Representative, no, I don't know of a cap. I can research it a little bit more, but I just talked with DAS during governor's budget, and we projected it out into the next few biennia.
And we use it for match money. This for preventative and as well as treatment. Mm-hmm. For the results of cigarette smoking, so it's a logical place to put it.
So I've been getting lobbied on other uses for it and other places and stuff, and I just wonder, how is that normal? Is that?
Yeah, we like every time.
Normal.
It's normal. We have been very strong advocates that you put it into this program, you match it 2-to-1, you can still then use it for preventative care and for the effects of the use of tobacco, which are huge. I mean, if you look at what it costs per pack of cigarettes for the cost of health care, it's about $7 or $8 per pack as the actual cost of what smoking does to people,
and
we all pay for.
18 is the figure.
Does it not go up again?
It was a few years ago somebody made the comment that it was 80% of the people on the health plan were using the 20% of the people in the health plan were using 80% of the dollars, and most of it was for tobacco related.
Yeah, those numbers gotten even tighter as I've looked at them.
Yeah.
I think we're down to 10, but we'll see. They're called social determinants, and smoking's in there, so that's part of it too. We'll probably hear about more of that as we go along.
Okay,
but it's a logical place, and just, I mean, people don't come to me and ask about this anymore. They just don't. They'll hit you guys up, and as chair of this committee, you know, save your breath, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, this money's going here. We need it here. We're going to match it up, and then we'll bring it back for prevention.
I just remember Senator Johnson comments about the ad that cost $1 million or ad campaign. Joe, I missed my lung or something, and people were looking at it like, what is that?
Mr. Chair?
How it gets spent is important.
What's that?
How it gets spent is important.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I should point out, I understand the rationale for doing it this way, but I just want to point out that we struggle a little bit because, for example, in Oregon we have this smoke shop certification program that's run through the health authority, and we actually have to use tobacco prevention dollars to pay for it. And I have legislation this session to change that because it strikes me as a little bit ironic to use tobacco prevention dollars to certify places that sell tobacco. So I'm hopeful that we can actually make that program a revenue neutral program because they're businesses and it's just like having a business license essentially to do something, and that we can then redirect more funds back into actual tobacco prevention. So that's my
personal plug for something that I hope will be coming your way soon.
So I know that you, going on to slide 11, I know that you covered some of this yesterday, and I hope it's not too much of a repeat for you. But just to put our overall Oregon Health Plan and our program into historical context, and I think it's been referenced already in this committee, over the last several biennium, we've actually been working very hard to change this dynamic of unsustainable healthcare cost increases, that we have a very uncoordinated, siloed healthcare delivery system that we're working to reform, and the Oregon Health Plan and the Medicaid program is part of those transformation efforts, as well as the federal healthcare reform with the Affordable Care Act and our choice to expand Medicaid. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about the fact that we've traditionally, as Senator Winters referenced earlier, we've struggled in the state on using the traditional levers to balance or to pay for these unsustainable healthcare costs, particularly in Medicaid and the state budget, by making choices to cut off people. We did that by limiting, or for example, by creating our so-called OHP standard, our lottery, or our reservation list, in which we randomly chose people off the list to get healthcare coverage. We've made choices to lower the poverty levels in the past to help pay for those to help lower costs, which does lead to cost shifting as people are uninsured, and it leads to not just cost shifting to other parts, you know, financial hardship to other parts of the state, but it also leads to a financial hardship for those families or those individuals who have to face those costs when they're uninsured. We've also had to cut off reduced payments to providers, or by reducing benefits. As we mentioned before, when I was talking about their prioritized list, that's another way in which we've made some decisions to change the benefits by essentially raising the funding line, covering fewer conditions, by limiting the benefits, for example, making cuts to the vision program as well as to the dental program. We've also reduced provider payments. That's a very common thing for Medicaid programs to do, and we did it here in Oregon as well. And that's a particular favorite of providers, because we ask them to provide the same services but for less money. So that all of those things wind up being essentially unsustainable and make for reduced access to care as more and more providers choose not to provide, not to take or accept Medicaid members within their communities. It leads to cost shifting. It leads to increased premiums that we all pay for being insured.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Moore-Peterson, thank you. Ms. Moore-Peterson, have you seen, my sense from talking to people in the medical community is that the number of providers, the providers who were previously closed to Medicaid have reopened with the advent of the CCOs, and that we actually have seen an increase in providers who do see Medicaid patients. Emma, is that perception accurate?
Co-chairs Bates and Nathanson and Senator Steiner Hayward. I've heard anecdotally those same things. I don't have anything hard and fast proof. In our state, we've always been on the high end as far as when we look nationally and compare ourselves nationally as to what proportion of our providers, of our physicians and nurse practitioners accept Medicaid, and that it's been running around between 83% to 85%. And that's relatively high. Also, all of our hospitals accept Medicaid, and that's actually not the case nationally either for Medicaid. You have And that's why you see a huge difference between public hospitals and private hospitals in some states. So they do in emergency rooms, but not generally.
Okay, good point. Yeah, so, I was like, what?
Yeah, they have to in the emergency rooms, but they don't have to in the inpatient stays, et cetera.
Gotcha.
So,
yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to follow up on one specific detail. The percent, 80-something percent, that you said was a little high, was that medical only? Does it include dental?
Oh, thank you for that question. It does not include dental only, and I will have to get back to you on what proportion, or I don't know if we have that statistic on how many dentists or dental providers have access to provide access to Medicaid patients. I don't know that.
I would really like to know if you could.
Judy, I think you get those numbers from the CCOs, the DCOs. I bet they have them at their fingertips.
It's highly likely, yes.
I'll be able to tell you very quickly.
I do know that there's a big difference between as I mentioned before, not all of people are enrolled into a coordinated care organization. There's a small proportion who remain fee-for-service, and their access to dental care is different, and there's a far fewer dentists who take so-called fee-for-service rates, the straight Medicaid rates, whereas they will work with either a coordinated care organization that has the dental care organization now in it.
Okay, and one follow-up. Sometimes, in addition to looking at a statewide average, it's good to look at something a little more detailed, like by geographic area or parsed out in some other way. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's an average, and the average looks really good, or it looks at least fair or acceptable. But then when you look at it, it's based on it's terrific in a bunch of places, and it's horrible in one or two others. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to reveal those anomalies when they occur.
Thank you, Coach Nathanson. That actually is that is the case. It is not universally 85% across the entire state. We do know that, in particularly in rural areas, where there's a struggle with access to care in general, and a shortage of particularly primary care providers as well as access to specialists, we do find that same dynamic that occurs more acutely for Medicaid. So that is a very astute observation. Yeah, I forgot where I was going with that.
To follow up my question, why don't we get those numbers together? The CCO should have the information, and there are different areas of, you know, the percentage of physicians and nurse practitioners taking on Medicaid patients. It's been a kind of a thorn for some people a long time.
Mm-hmm.
We call them country club practices, when a primary physician won't take Medicare or Medicaid, just does commercial. Commercial rates being set high because of the low payment by Medicare and Medicaid. So it's probably worthwhile taking a look at.
Yes, Co-Chair Bates, we have taken a look at, we've done a survey. We've partnered up with the Oregon Medical Association for a number of years in doing a survey of physicians in the state. And then they look at not just Medicaid, but of course they're looking at also private pay and Medicare. And as we noted earlier, because of the Medicare rates, access for Medicare patients isn't much better than what it is for Medicaid. So it's notable that Medicaid is as good as it is, and it's in the ballpark, not as good, but in the ballpark for with Medicare. And comparatively speaking, when I talk with and I work with my colleagues in other states, their access to care tends to be much more challenging, and they tend to rely on safety net clinics a lot more than we do. We do rely on safety net clinics like federally qualified health centers to provide care for Oregon Health Plan members, but not. Not to the same degree that many other states' Medicaid programs do. And I think in large part it is due to the coordinated care organizations working within their communities to engage the healthcare providers, et cetera, and in a very active way to ensure coverage for their community.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that, Judy. I do hear from my daughter works for a federally qualified health clinic, and one of their biggest challenges is attracting staff and medical staff, too. And I don't know what, you know, they do all kinds of inventive things to attract people to our area, which is a pretty nice area. And one of the biggest challenges is finding employment for their spouses or partners.
Mm-hmm. Trailing
spouse problem.
It is, and I don't know if there's a special angle that you could help, you know, facilitate somehow, because that I hear that a lot, not just from her, but from her boss, too. And then just people in the area and some of the doctors, like Dr. Schaefer was my doctor and went to DMAP, and he's retiring now.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I remember hearing 40 years ago when he came, the reason they stayed so long is they wanted a nice, quiet place to raise their family, but that was close to Portland because of the cultural activities, because his wife's an artist, and you know, it's really tough. It's really tough, and they get somebody in there, and they last a few months or a year, and then they're gone again, and it's just this constant change.
Thank you for that. I think that I think other parts of the Oregon Health Authority focus a lot more on the recruitment and the how to expand access to care, et cetera. And we can pass that along as far as your interest in that particular topic area.
I would just point out for the newer members of this committee that this committee actually has a role in helping with that issue. This past biennium, or the biennium that we're in the process of finishing, we put $7 million into loan recruitment, loan forgiveness and loan repayment programs for a range of different healthcare providers serving the underserved. And the hope is that we will be putting a substantial amount in as well. I'm also working to set up a conversation with Sean Robbins at Business Oregon about this very issue of the trailing spouses, because I firmly believe this is a business issue.
What do you call it, spouses?
Trailing. One spouse is moving and the other one's coming along behind.
Maybe the husband or the wife.
Right.
Yeah, either one.
And because I do firmly believe that it's a business development, economic development issue, because if we don't have good health care in a community, it's really tough for employers to want to grow their businesses there.
That's
so
really good.
I really see this as an economic development issue. And there are other economic issues associated.
Representative Nathan, I'm going to give you the last word, then we're going to close down.
Thank you. I, too, think it's a very serious problem, access in rural or underserved areas. But I'm concerned about it in a slightly different way. We spend over $15 million a year in incentives. That's loan repayment, loan forgiveness, tax breaks, and some other incentives. Over $15 million a year. We're not sure how much of this actually moves the dial. And I think we need a broader conversation on what is it that's needed. For example, one of the suggestions to me is that if you are the only provider in a community, burnout is a serious problem. Yes. If you are the person on call 24/7, week after week after week, maybe you just can't last. And all the money that was spent on incentives to recruit or retain might not be of enough value unless you're also recruiting a second or a third. Maybe we should focus on a team rather than an individual. That's one of the points. There are several things that may be impacting this turnover in a local community.
So I
think we need a broader discussion.
I think you're right, and I agree. So we're going to close it down today, and we'll be back here on Monday at 8:30. I hope you found the discussion not overwhelming, but interesting and helpful to you. And we'll continue this for, I think, two more days or three.
One and a half. Some flexibility on that third day.
Thank you. So we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm supposed to
pick
the oil.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alan, I'm supposed to pick the oil.